Many of you know we're in the book of Isaiah this year, excited to be there. And for just as a reminder, Isaiah was a prophet. And a prophet is an authorized messenger from God to speak on behalf of God with the authority from God. And so in doing this, in the book of Isaiah, prophets were able to speak on behalf of God to his people, to the subjects that he appointed to. And he was speaking to expose sins, to announce consequences for the way they were living, to make a case, and even convince and convict those who were speaking to in order for them to return back to God. The goal was to warn and invite those who are receiving the warning to not stay in that state, but to renounce their old ways and return back to God, since God is willing to receive and accept those who would return. So Isaiah is a prophet speaking on behalf of God and trying to warn, if not convict those to stop and return. And so Isaiah's ministry is before Israel, and he's proclaiming this message to them. And at this time, as you guys know, Israel is made up of 12 tribes. And we see this in 1 Kings 12, and we see that after David, King David, unites the tribes under one nation, and his son takes over. But because of his son Solomon's idolatry, and then Solomon's son's brash leadership, the kingdom, the 12 tribes, basically split. Not basically, they split. So the north has 10 tribes. North would be considered Israel. And then the south is considered Judah. And then in Judah, there's 2 tribes there. And so in this chapter, and in the chapters we've been reading in Isaiah 5, there's been a focus on Judah. There's been a focus on Judah. As you guys remember, in chapter 1, there's been talks specifically tied to Judah. And to think about Judah, during this time, you have to think about Judah being relatively well off. Judah is relatively well off during this time. Most would actually even say they're doing way better than their brothers or the tribes up north during this time. And it's because a lot of it is tied to the long and successful reign of King Uzziah. His long and successful reign is seen in 2 Chronicles 26. King Uzziah sought after the Lord during the early part of his reign, and God blessed him. Blessed him and Judah, the southern kingdom. They received military victories, expanded their territories, they built fortified towers, they were secure, they developed agriculture and livestock, and ultimately they became famous and strong throughout their time. But as you read 2 Chronicles 26, King Uzziah was strong, but then proud. And because of his pride, he died. He had an unlawful entry into the temple and received leprosy and died. And so from Uzziah comes the reign of Jotham, and this is the setting of where we're at in regards to Isaiah. So Judah is relatively successful. They have great military power, victory. They're strong. They're successful. And so as you look at them as a nation externally, they're strong, secure, well-to-do, potentially. Yet inwardly, these people are spiritually broken and corrupt, full of empty religion, pride, injustice, unrighteousness. As you guys remember from last week, in chapter 1, Isaiah had this to say about Judah. They were spiritually sick and rebellious nation. They were laden, filled with sin. They had left the Lord. They were doing all these spiritual rituals and sacrifices, but God ignored them because their hands were full of blood. Their leaders, the leaders of Judah, were corrupt, taking bribes, allowing injustices to happen for their benefit. And this is bad, bad news. Not only were they bearing bad fruit, there were consequences for their actions. Not only for that, for the kingdom, for the king, for the people, but flowed throughout the nation. So we, and then we get into chapter 5, which we'll be looking at tonight. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 8. And as you read it, I'm going to read it for us. We read verse 1. Let me sing for my beloved, my love song concerning his vineyard. So you see, Isaiah the prophet is singing a song. It's like a ballad. And I was like, oh, I'm singing a song. What is this song about? And we find out. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. And he looked for it to yield grapes. But it yielded wild grapes. Verse 3 in chapter 5. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem, men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. This vineyard that is producing wild grapes when I was expecting grapes. This is what's going to be done in verse 5. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall. It shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. I will also command the clouds that the rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. And the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. And he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. Looked for righteousness, but behold, an outcry. So we're in Isaiah chapter 5, and we're looking at 1 through 8. And we're talking about this vineyard. It's almost like a parable of this illustration that Isaiah is performing in a song to get the attention of the people listening, getting the attention of Judah, of the southern kingdom. And we see that this vineyard is planted on one of the best locations that you can have. Like in real estate, you call it about location, location, location. Similarly, for agriculture in that time, it's about the location of where this vineyard would be planted so that they can get the sustenance and all the things that they need so that they can produce grapes. Because as you produce grapes, it'll be great for them to consume, great for them to be able to sell business and be able to grow their town in that way. But we see an issue. What is the issue? In verse 2. When the time comes, when the season has blossomed, when the time is right where grapes are supposed to be found, what is found? Verse 2 says it. Wild grapes. Fruit that is rotten. And the question that is being posed in the song is, who's at fault? What's wrong? Wait, didn't I plant this vineyard on one of the best grounds that there is? Didn't I, in verse 2, dig and clear it of stones and prepared it so it can be able to receive all the sustenance that it needs for it to grow? Didn't I build a watchtower to protect it? Didn't I hew out a wine vat to receive all the grapes from it? And yet, wild grapes are born. And so I was thinking about this There's a guy by the name of Johnny Kim. Johnny Kim. He is known in the community as the triple threat person. So I know some of you even have, or your parents have, like the Tiger Mom car stickers, or the Dragon Dads who are like super intense and want you to get into the good schools, the best this and that and the other. Johnny Kim is the epitome of the ideal person. So Johnny Kim, after he graduated from high school, he went into the Navy SEALs, and he survived this training called BUDS training. And I didn't realize that 80% of people who go through that training fail, quit, or didn't pass, right? So he passed that, and then this Johnny Kim guy goes to war and serves in 100 missions, being a medic, a sniper, point person, and then receives all these awards afterwards. He survives after all those mission trips. Those battle trips, survives, gets these awards, and then he decides to get a medical degree. And not just any medical degree. He got it from Harvard. He got it from Harvard as a Harvard Medical School, went to get his medical degree there. And then after that, so not only did he serve in the Army as a Navy SEAL, went to go to Harvard to get his medical degree, so now he's a doctor, but now he's also a NASA astronaut. A NASA astronaut, right? Beating over 18,000 applicants to be selected to be part of this group. And then he also was part of a trip that was able to go to International Space Station, go into space for 240 days, and was able to do scientific research there. So this is like almost the epitome I know my parents would have tried to match me up to be. And if you can imagine, right, if Johnny Kim came here or at a conference, and one of my Dragon Dads or Tiger Moms asked, hey, Johnny Kim, what is the blueprint to be like you, if not better than you, right? You always want the next generation to be better. What is that blueprint? And then Johnny Kim gives you a whole host, pages upon pages, of what you need to do. And your parents are writing it down, recording it, writing it down, writing it down. And they got that list. Right? I was like, okay, I need to take them to the best school. I need to take them to Kumon. I need them to do all these extracurricular activities. I need them to sleep 24 hours a day. I need them to do these trips. And okay, got it, right? And somehow, some way, your parents are able to set that environment up for you to be the next Connie Lim or Adam Smith or this Johnny Kim guy, right? And they set up this environment. They find the best schools. They find the Kumon Academy. They find the extracurriculars, do all these things. You sleep for 26 hours. Do all those things, right? What do you expect to be the result of someone who accomplishes all these things? I know what you don't expect. I know you don't expect them, after finishing all these things, to just be sitting at home, looking at their computer screen all day, all night, scrolling through things, or going to be a social media star just to talk down to people. Wow, you're really slow. Wow, you're really lazy. Man, I wish you were smarter. I know you wouldn't be expecting that. Nor would you be expecting them just to squander all the talents and resources they had because of all that has been built up into it. And I make that funny illustration to point out this was the situation that Isaiah is pointing out. God has provided ample opportunities for Israel to produce fruit, and they bore nothing. Wild grapes, stinking fruit, nothing. And there's consequences for it. We see in Isaiah 5, verse 8. I know there's projector things. I didn't even send it in time, so it's no biggie. There's this famous Hebrew wordplay in Isaiah 5, verse 7. Isaiah 5, verse 7. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. So it's saying, this is the pronouncement. This vineyard that should have produced fruit, grapes, good results, that didn't, is Israel. The men of Judah are his pleasant planting. And what God was looking for was looking for justice, but instead he received bloodshed. Was looking for righteousness, but instead received an outcry. And in Hebrew, there's this famous wordplay. Justice, and I'll send it out later. In Hebrew, it's mishpat, M-I-S-P-H-A-T. But there's another word that looks really similar to that. So mishpat means justice. Bloodshed, you're looking for justice, but you get bloodshed. Bloodshed is spelled M-I-S-P-A-C-H. So it looks really similar, but the last two letters of bloodshed is C-H instead of T. So there's this wordplay that's going on in regards to justice. You're expecting justice, but you get bloodshed. You're expecting righteousness, which in Hebrew is tzedak. And similarly, there's another wordplay there too. It's spelled really similar, but it's different. Righteousness, but you get cry of distress. And I was thinking that it's similar for some of you who know Chinese people. In Chinese, in Mandarin, there's a word. For those who speak Mandarin, how do you say mom in Chinese?
Ma.
Ma, M-A, right? How do you say horse in Chinese?
Ma.
How do you say scolding? How do you scold somebody in Chinese? Whoa, wait. So Ben, thank you for participating. But so the word in Chinese for mom is M-A. Ma. There's different tonations. There's four tonations. Ma is one tonation that says mom. And there's another tonation, same word, M-A, but you say it, it says horse. There's another M-A, you say it, it's scolding. And then there's another M-A, I don't quite know. You can ask another Chinese person. But it's this wordplay that's happening. It's like the modern day Kendrick Lamar type of thing that's happening. That Isaiah is judging Israel and saying, I was looking for this, and yet you did not have justice. You did bloodshed. I was looking for righteousness. Instead, there was outcry. And so these two words are one of the highest covenantal ideals that we see from the Old Testament. These words are close enough and sound as, and the switch feels sharp and deliberate. Hebrew listeners who would hear this song would have landed with the same kind of jolt and mix up that we would have had when we were like, are you saying mom or are you saying horse? Except Isaiah does this on purpose for a prophetic effect. He makes the two highest covenantal ideals by changing only a couple sounds and turns them into a horrific opposite. And this justice and righteousness that we talk about, justice, when we talk about justice, it's this fair and right ordering of life according to God's standards. It's like making things right in the public life. This justice idea includes protecting the vulnerable, judging impartially in the courts, refusing to favor the rich or the powerful. It's making things right in the public life. It's how a community, it's how a society is supposed to work when people follow God's way. The weak are protected instead of crushed. Courts don't favor the rich or the powerful or the popular. People are treated fairly, no matter how much money or power they have. Justice is what looks like in society that's actually ran and designed by God. So that's justice. There's righteousness. Righteousness. And righteousness is more relational. It's personal. It's a right relationship and right conduct with one another. Living in a way that reflects God's own character in dealing with each other. Righteousness is dealing with each other. Living rightly in your relationships. It's personal. It's relational. It's treating people with same fairness and loyalty that we have received from God and God has shown us. Doing what's right even when no one else is watching. It's reflecting God's character and how you deal with other people. And so if justice is about the whole community and functioning correctly, righteousness is the way each person should be living in that society with one another. So together they describe a society shaped by this covenant in which the strong do not crush the weak and the courts are not for sale and the people are treated with loyalty and fairness. God has already made this clear earlier in Deuteronomy 16, verse 18 to 20, and passages like Leviticus 19 to 15, 19, verse 15, Exodus 23, 1 through 9. God has commanded Israel to pursue justice without partiality, especially for the poor, the widow, the orphans, the weak, the sojourner. So Isaiah is not making up this new standard for them to live by. He's proclaiming what's been spoken of from hundreds of years ago. And he's calling his people to return because they're not living that way. Israel is not living that way. And so that's why God is pronouncing this judgment. That's what we see in verse 5 to 7. What's going to happen to this vineyard? It's going to be removed. It's going to be devoured. It's going to be trampled down. It's going to be broken down. It's going to be a waste. There's not going to be pruned or hoed. Briars and thorns are going to be growing in it. The clouds will cover it and there will be no rain. There's judgment on this vineyard. And that's why God was so angry, because his people had the right religion on the outside. It looked like they were doing everything right on the outside. But inside, they were producing this wrong fruit. And so Isaiah elaborates on Israel's sins as we look in verse 8 all the way to the end of this chapter, at the end of chapter 5. And there's the six woes, W-O-E-S, right? Woes, or W-O-E. And it's a prophetic, in the prophetic context, a woe is a cry of lament. It's a severe caution. It's an urgent alarm about impending judgment. And all that's like wrapped together in one box. So it's like really important. Like, whoa, don't do it. Watch out. It's a burning building. Get out. So it's more than just a simple warning. It's a grave warning that something bad is going to happen and happen to the people that they're talking to. And we see six of these from verse 8 to 30. And commentators have grouped them into two groups. Verses 8 to 12, talking about how Israel was abusing their material possessions, using it for themselves, grabbing property, getting drunk, being self-indulgent, doing things for themselves, using material possessions to bless themselves. And then verse 18 to 23, there's four other woes that are focused on this moral, spiritual failure of Israel. They're dragging sin along, calling evil good, reversing the moral order, being wise in their own eye, and corrupt leadership and justice. And so when we look at verse 8, woe to those who join house to house, who add field to field until there's no more room and you are made to dwell alone in the midst of the land. The Lord of hosts has sworn in my hearing. Surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without inhabitant. 10 acres of vineyard shall yield but one bath, and a homer seed shall yield but an ephah. So the issue here is a moral issue in regards to greed and expansion that Israel had. They had the finances, they had the means to be able to buy. I'll just finish that and now I'll make another point. This is a greedy expansion of property and power at the expense of others. They're expanding, getting more powerful, getting more rich, adding more to their portfolio at the expense of others. Wealthy and influential people keep acquiring homes and fields until smaller landowners are pushed out and there's no place that remains for them. But God has told us in his word earlier that he's given each of the family an inheritance, a shared portion in the land, and is treated, instead, Israel is treating this as a commodity to be accumulated. This drive to possess more and more overrides their concern, their right concern for righteousness, for caring for one another, for justice. It overrides their drive and greed, overrides their concern for the well-being and right place, right well-being of others and rightful places of others. This is not a neutral economic, financial success plan. It's the use of strength. It's the use of strength and power to displace, to dominate against others, producing the opposite of justice God had required. And then in verse 11 to 12, those who rise early to pursue strong drink and linger into evening until wine inflames them. The moral issue here is a deliberate ordering of life around intoxication and pleasure. Their days begin and end with the pursuit of pleasure. Music and feasting fill their time, yet they give no attention. They give no attention to the deeds of the Lord or the works of his hand. You see that in verse 12. They have a lyre and harp and tambourine and flute and wine at their feet, but they do not regard the deeds of the Lord or see the work of his hands. That's the second woe. The third woe is in verse 18 to 19. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of falsehood, who draw sin as with cart ropes, who say, let him be quick, let him speed his work, that we may see it. Let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near. Let it come, that we may know it. And this woe exposes the progressive and willful nature of sin. What begins as something they can still manage becomes an enslaving force they drag along with great effort. A cart of ropes. They're not struggling against sin. They're actively pulling it. They're actively pursuing it. This moral issue deepens in verse 19 when they challenge God to hurry up, show his work. If his apparent delay justifies their, if his delay, if he doesn't come, then it justifies their actions, justifies the rebellion. Sin is defended by deceit, and God's patience is treated as evidence that he will not act. If he doesn't come, then I guess it's fine. And many would say the next woe in verse 20 is sort of what sums up the issue that we see in Israel. Verse 20, Isaiah 5, verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. Who put darkness for light and light for darkness. Who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. This is this moral reversal that's happening. The moral order is inverted. The problem is no longer only wrong actions, but the deliberate redefinition of moral reality. What God has named evil is now labeled as good. And what he has called good is now treated as evil. And there's this deeper corruption than just simple disobedience. It's an assault on God's categories that he's already established. When the ability to distinguish good from evil is lost or rejected, the foundation of moral life collapses. This is the issue that we're seeing in the time of Israel, in the area, in the southern kingdom of Judah. This moral reversal. And it continues in verse 21. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and shrewd in their own sight. It's this intellectual and moral pride. These people have become the law themselves. They understand their understanding is treated as sufficient. They no longer need the wisdom of God. They no longer need God's correction. What they have, they're self-sufficient. But this self-sufficiency is not neutral. It closes the door to repentance. It closes the door on God, because the person who is wise in his own eyes sees no need to change. There sees nothing is wrong and needs to be repented of, stopped, changed, and redone. Sees nothing, sees none of that. Pride of mind becomes a fortress. Pride of mind becomes a fortress against the word of the Lord. And the last woe we see in 22 and 23. Woe to those who are heroes of drinking wine, valiant men and mixing strong drink, and quit the guilty for a bribe, and deprive the innocent of his rights. And just another moral issue of misuse of influence and power. The sections I skipped that I'm going to highlight now is the therefores. We see therefore section in verse 13 to 16. And we see a therefore section in verse 25 to 30. In verse 13 to 16 says, "Therefore my people go into exile for the lack of knowledge. Their honored men go hungry. Their multitude is parched with thirst. Therefore Sheol has enlarged its appetite. It's opened its mouth beyond measure. And the nobility of Jerusalem and her multitude will go down. Her revelers and he who exalt in her. Man is humbled and each one is brought low. And the eyes of the haughty are brought low. But the Lord of hosts is exalted in justice. And the holy God shows himself holy in righteousness." We see here what happens. There's a result, there's a consequence that happens in light of all these woes. And Isaiah is pronouncing that people in verse 13 who ignore the Lord's way are going to be removed from the land. People are going to go who are living in excess, drinking, eating, playing, doing all these things, will now face want, will now face hunger, starvation. Verse 14, there will be death and it will swallow all these pomp and noisy celebrators against God. Those who are proud are brought low. Arrogance is humbled. And yet God's own righteousness, his justice is exalted. And then the great houses where all these places of vineyards, these houses in the states that were seized will be accumulated and become empty pasture lands. And the big judgment that we're coming up upon is the judgment that we see, therefore, in verse 25. In verse 25 of Isaiah chapter 5, it says, "Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against his people, and he stretched out his hand against them to strike them. And the mountains quaked, and their corpses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger has not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. He will raise a signal for a nation far away and whistle for them from the ends of the earth. And behold, quickly, speedily, they'll come. None is weary. None stumbles. None slumbers or sleeps. Not a waistband is loose. Not a sandal strap is broken. Their arrows are sharp. All their bows are bent. Their horses' hoofs seem like flint. Their wheels like the whirlwind. Their roaring is like a lion. Like young lions as they roar, they growl and seize their prey. They carry it off, and none can rescue." Verse 30, "They growl over it on that day like the growling of the sea. And if one looks to that land, behold, darkness and distress, and the light is darkened by its clouds." And Isaiah here isn't saying that, oh, if you continue to do this, this is the warning. Isaiah is not saying that, please guys, please, this is what I'm telling you, this is what's going to happen if you keep doing this. Isaiah is telling us that this is what's going to happen because of their sins, because they've forgotten God, because when God came to see justice and righteousness, he saw bloodshed and outcry. Judgment and doom is coming for Israel. You know how I read in the beginning, Deuteronomy 28, in regards to the blessings for obedience? If you read the rest of chapter 28 of Deuteronomy, the rest, it's, I forgot, I counted and I forgot. All right, let's do it. Deuteronomy 28. The blessings for obedience was from 1 to 14. Disobedience was from 15 to 68. If you disobey God, this is what will happen. If you disobey God, this is what will happen. And you see the fruition of that. In Deuteronomy 28:15, if you will not obey, all these curses shall come upon you. Deuteronomy 28, verse 30 to 33. You shall build a house, but not dwell in it. Plant a vineyard, but not enjoy its fruit. Ox are slaughtered before your eyes. You produce given, your produce is given to your enemies. Verse 33. People you do not know shall eat the fruit of your grounds. Verse 41. You shall father sons and daughters, but they shall not be yours. They shall go into captivity. Verse 45 to 46. The curses shall pursue you until you are destroyed if you disobey God. They shall be a sign and a wonder. Verse 49 to 50. In Deuteronomy 28, the Lord will bring a nation against you from far away, and that nation is fierce. Verse 51, they shall eat the offspring of your cattle and the fruit of your ground. There's no rest. Night and day you shall be in dread. In morning you shall say, it was only evening. So God has depicted for us the consequence of disobedience, and Israel is showing their disobedience fully. And Isaiah's here to pronounce, to warn them, stop, or this is going to happen. And it's not or this is going to happen. This will happen. But we know in the book of Isaiah, the judgment is not the final end, is not the point or purpose. It's not to destroy the land. Judgment is led to restoration. Judgment leads to restoration. And what I didn't read for us, what I potentially could have read, was Isaiah chapter 4, verse 2 to 8. And it's very interesting. If you guys read Isaiah 1 through 5, you see in the odd chapters, 1, 3 and 5, judgment, warning, condemnation. But in the even chapters, chapters 2 and chapter 4, there's a section there where there's hope. There's hope. In Isaiah 4, there's hope for us. In that day, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land shall be the pride and honor of the survivors of Israel. One day, there will be that branch of the Lord. Beautiful, glorious, there will be fruit, and it will be honored by all the survivors. And we see in John 15, we see, because we have the blessing to be on this side of the cross. We have his book. We have the word to be able to see the fullness that what Isaiah was preaching to Israel is not the end. And John 15 says, Jesus says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes so he can bear more fruit. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. Whoever abides in me, and I in him,
He it is that bears much fruit. From apart from me, you can do nothing. And it's this. And Jesus is saying all these things. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be full. And so we hear these words, that pronouncement of disobedience, when we look externally righteous and good and spiritually spectacular, we know inside our hearts evil, corruption, sin, death. And yet that is not the end. We know it's not the end because Christ has come. He has come to be that vine. He has come to be able to bear our burdens, to rescue us from our sins, so that we can be with him, so that we can have our joy be in him, so that we can find our faith and our confidence and our hope in him. We can find eternal life and salvation in him.